Hello, everyone. This is Brent Johnson with Milkshakes, Markets, and Madness. This is a show where we talk about the financial markets and all the madness that surrounds not only those markets, but the world around us. And we do it through the lens of the dollar milkshake theory, which is a framework for thinking about how a sovereign debt and currency crisis could potentially play out and the role of the global reserve currency in those markets. And if anybody is new to the show, welcome. For the longtime subscribers and listeners, you know that we have a little bit of a new format as of last week. And the new format is going to be that there is no common format. As of right now, what we are going to do going forward is a little bit of everything. Sometimes you're going to have me come on and just talk. Sometimes I'm going to go over some charts and some things I'm looking about and thinking about in the markets. Sometimes I may have one guest on, and sometimes I may have a couple different guests on where we can have either a lively debate or just a lively discussion. But if anybody is new, there was also, you can go to our website or to our playlist here, and you know, you can go way down the rabbit hole on the Start Here playlist if you're not familiar with the dollar milkshake theory and all the stuff that we have talked about before. And for anyone who tuned in last week, you'll know we talked about, well, it's funny, we kind of talked about what we talked about 2 weeks ago, because 2 weeks ago we talked about how markets were very overbought and that a number of different signals that I was looking at were indicating it was time to not just have hedges on, but to increase the hedges and even be, you know, net short as a result. And as we spoke last week, that started to play out pretty well. And I went through a number of reasons and actually showed some of the indicators that I looked at. So if that's something that you're interested in, again, go back to last week's show and you can review some of those indicators and signals that I used to kind of make that decision. And, you know, one thing I'll say is I've been doing this for 25 years now. And in the 25 years, I had never seen a situation where all the signals hit at once. And I would guess that I could do this for another 25 years and we'll never see a confluence of signals like I did in the middle of July again. But anyway, the decision to dramatically increase the hedges and even be net short was a good one, because 2 weeks ago we saw the market start to fall. And then we had the Fed meeting this week, and we had a non-farm payrolls number this week, and it continued the move to the downside. Now, here's the funny thing, is a lot of people are talking about this is the end of the world. You know, here it comes. It's the big crash, 1929 all over again. But really, markets were only down a couple of 2 to 3% this week. And, you know, maybe they were down 2 to 3% last week. And so I think the tech, the NASDAQ is probably down 7 or 8% from its high. S&P and Dow were probably down 3, 4, 5% from their high. So we haven't seen a real crash yet, and markets are really kind of only back to where they were in April or May. But what we did see is a dramatic rise in the VIX. The VIX went from 13 to 30, and then I think it pulled back to 25 or something by the end of the day on Friday. But there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, Powell messed up. Powell should have cut rates on Wednesday. He didn't. He indicated that they still needed to see more evidence that inflation was coming down, and they needed to see more evidence that the labor market was tightening, and, you know, all this stuff. And so, you know, what I kind of find funny is that all year, or even before, for the last several months, all I have heard is that the Fed and the Treasury are in big trouble, because interest rates have risen dramatically, and the Fed and the Treasury now has to refinance all this debt, because they over the last couple of years they issued a lot of short-term debt, and now they have to refinance that now that rates are significantly higher. And my gosh, what are they going to do? Rates are just going to continue going higher, and, you know, the financing costs will just balloon. And the thing is, though, this last week, as equities sold off pretty hard and as volatility rose, yields came down quite a bit. And so the Fed and the Treasury no longer have to worry as much about these higher refinancing costs. And there's a lot of people who think that those yields are going to continue to come down as we continue to have more pain in the markets. And so it's very possible that all of the people who said that the Fed was stuck because interest rates were going to rise and they have to finance at higher rates will be wrong, and that they will be now refinancing at lower rates. But that's not really the funny part that I find. The part that I find funny is, again, for the last several months, they were worried about how the Fed was going to refinance at these higher rates. Well, now that markets have started to come down, many of those same people are saying, see, the Fed is stuck. They don't know what to do. They must be freaking out that this is happening. Well, if they were wanting, if they were worried about higher rates being a problem for them refinancing, and they wanted rates to come down, and they wanted to be able to refinance at lower rates, then why on earth would they be upset after the price action last week? Now, I'll admit that they probably don't want markets to crash 20, 30, 40%. And of course, if that happened, they're going to come in and they're going to do QE and they're going to go back to all these incredible monetary policies. But as of right now, funding costs have fallen fairly dramatically in a very short time period. And stock markets have only come down, you know, 5 to 10%. They're back to where they were kind of in late Q1 or early Q2. They're still up dramatically from where they were a couple of years ago. And now financing costs are lower. So that's what I kind of find. That's one of the things that I kind of find interesting this week. The other thing that's kind of interesting is the many people that said the next time there's a crisis, yields won't fall, they'll rise because the debts have gotten so big and the budget deficits have gotten so big and the market is not going to want to continue refinancing the Treasury at these 4.5 or 4 to 5% rates. Rates are going to go to 6%, 7%, 8%. They won't buy Treasuries the next time there's a crisis. Well, they bought Treasuries this last week. And again, you know, people always say, who's going to buy the debt? Well, as of right now, the market has been very happy to buy the debt. Now, here's the thing. I'm actually not a huge bond bull. I'm not a Treasury bull. I own a bunch of short-term Treasuries, but I don't own bonds or some, you know, T-bills, but I don't own a bunch of long-term bonds. I'm not betting on the long end of the curve falling dramatically. I know a number of people that are. I actually don't think it's a bad bet to do it. I know some people have already made some good money doing that. I think George is one of them. George Gammon, my buddy George Gammon, I think bought some call options on TLT recently. And so, you know, it's not that I don't understand that argument. I'm just saying I am personally not making that bet. Part of the reason I'm not making that bet is I think in the years ahead, while I certainly understand the reasoning for yields to fall dramatically, I still think it's possible that they go higher. But I do not think that we are going to end up in a situation where the world refuses to finance the U.S. Treasury, but continues to finance Egypt or Australia or South Africa or Turkey or England or Italy or China or Russia, but at the same time refuse to buy U.S. Treasuries. So I think sovereign yields in general can all rise, but I don't think we will get into a situation where the rest of the world repudiates U.S. treasuries and goes crazy to buy foreign treasuries. So I think this idea that the Fed is currently freaking out because of what's going on in the market is to miss the point of their primary concern. Their primary concern is to keep the U.S. government functioning. That is the primary role of a central bank. And they will be the lender of last resort if it comes to that. But so far, they're probably not totally upset with price action over the last week or so. The other part is I don't think that the Fed is shocked at what has happened. Remember, a couple years ago when they started raising interest rates, the whole reason to raise interest rates in the first place was to tame animal spirits and get inflation and prices down. The reason that they raised rates to do that is a way that typically ends up slowing down an economy. So the idea that they were purposefully trying to slow the economy by raising rates, and now they are shocked because the economy is slowing, I think is to, again, misunderstand why they were raising rates in the first place. Now, I've also talked about how over the last couple of years, when they first started raising rates, I think they thought they were going to have to cause a recession and perhaps even a painful recession in order to get inflation lower. And several times I mentioned how Powell was one of the more plain spoken central bankers and clear spoken central bankers that I could remember, because he very clearly said jobs may have to be lost. Pain may have to be felt, but that they felt the pain of raising rates and slowing the economy was better long-term than the long-term pain of long-term inflation. So again, the idea that raising rates was going to slow the economy in some way and cause prices to come down, I think that was expected all along. I think what they didn't expect was the markets to go up as high and for as long as they did. I think that was the surprise. And the further markets went higher and the longer they rose, I think the central bankers, Fed or Powell in particular, started to think, well, you know, when I started this process, I didn't think I'd be able to pull this off without a lot of pain. But now we're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're getting inflation down. It's getting pretty close to our target and asset prices are high. Maybe, just maybe, we can pull this off, right? And so I think as that started to happen, you know, then he started talking about slowing the glide path. We don't want to come in. We don't want a hard landing. We want a smooth landing. So I'm not sitting here saying that I think that they are trying to crash the markets. I just don't think they're surprised by it. And, you know, if markets continue, and the other thing is they have very clearly said that they want to cut rates. You know, they've been telegraphing that for a year now. But so far, they haven't had the cover. In other words, they haven't had the economic cover as far as crashing inflationary prints, slowing economy, falling stock prices that would allow them to go cut rates. And so while they have wanted to do it, they haven't done it because the markets really haven't let them do it. But now, when they have been very clear that they want to cut rates, and we've talked many times about how we thought that they would cut in September, now that they're starting to get some pain in the market, now that there's some volatility in the market, now that gives them the cover to cut. If markets had not experienced what we experienced the last 2 weeks, and the VIX was at 12, and jobs were still plentiful, and the economy was still humming along come some September, they would not be able to cut. But with what's going on now, it gives them the ability to. Not only that, if this continues, which I think it probably will, that not only gives them the ability to cut, but it gives them the ability to cut 50 basis points rather than 25. So as it is right now, I don't think the Fed is too upset of the price action. We'll have to wait and see how it goes. But, you know, the other thing I would say is it kind of relates to this is, you know, there people have often trying to figure out, like, why has the market stayed high for as long as it has? And why haven't higher rates, you know, caused a recession? And along with that is why has the curve stayed uninverted for so long? And why has the market not, you know, priced in a massive recession? And I think there's a couple things. One is we've explained this many times, again, going back to the dollar milkshake theory. When the very first time I mentioned this in 2008, I basically said this was very similar to Soros and Druckenmiller's imperial circle, where you have an economy where the government is stimulating and spending a lot of money combined. So you've got loose fiscal policy combined with interest rates that are now higher. So the higher interest rates pull capital into the market. And again, back in 2018, I said interest rates were headed higher. U.S. Treasury prices were going to fall after a 40-year bond bull market. And that would pull capital in the United States. And despite the higher rates, U.S. equity prices would rise. And that's largely what we have seen happen. So that partly explains what's been going on. But the other thing that, you know, people have wondered, why has there been so much liquidity? Why hasn't interest rates, you know, caused the economy to slow? Part of it has to do with the Fed and the Treasury are somewhat at odds. The Treasury has been spending money into the economy. Many times we've talked about the TGA and how they drew the TGA down and then they build the TGA back up and then they would spend all that money. And that Treasury spending provides the liquidity. And then they also not only have done that, but they have also changed well, they haven't changed, but they have dramatically shortened the maturity on the issuance of bonds that they have sent out. There's actually a word for it. I can't think of it right now. Artificial financial, it's ATI or something like that. And I can't remember the actual term, but it's basically talking about how the Treasury has been at odds with the Fed. While the Fed has been trying to rein in liquidity and slow the economy, of course, the executive branch under which the Treasury falls doesn't want to slow an economy. They're politicians. They want liquidity. And so the policies of the Treasury over the last couple of years have oftentimes been in conflict with the policies of the Fed. And there was actually a pretty good paper that was put out recently. It's by Hudson Bay, and I'll actually drop this into the link or into the show description where you can read and they discuss in pretty good detail what the Treasury has been doing to offset the liquidity that the Fed has been trying to drain. And I'm not going to go into all the details from this paper, but essentially what this paper says is a couple things. One is that by dramatically shortening the maturity of the bonds that they're issuing, they've been funding the government via T-bills. So this does a couple things. One thing that it does is that the people that are buying these T-bills, they have more liquidity than they otherwise naturally would because these are short-term bonds. They come due much quicker. And when a bond comes due much quicker, you will think of that bond in a different way than a bond that you bought that was 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years long, right? And so because the government has been issuing so many T-bills, other than buying them in the secondary market, there hasn't been a lot of 10, 15, 20-year T-bonds to buy, right? And so by sending out all of this short-term funding to the market has by necessity been a bit more of a liquid market than it otherwise would be. That's not so much what the paper focused on. That's just one thing that I think is important to consider. But what the paper focused on more was that this is sort of a way to get the market to do QE for the Fed. Or for the government, for the Treasury. And if the Fed wasn't going to do the QE, then they would just get the market to do it. Now, how does that work? Well, again, you kind of have to understand how the monetary system works and why big asset allocators and why hedge funds, governments, central banks, you know, these big players, why they buy bonds, government bonds, U.S. government bonds in the first place. Jeff Snyder has talked about this a lot. But essentially, the reason they buy U.S. government bonds is because, you know, from a regulatory capital perspective, you have to hold AAA rated securities. Well, there's nothing more AAA rated, at least from an official standpoint, than a U.S. Treasury. But then the way the system works is that they take these treasuries and they pledge them as collateral. The whole system is designed around collateral and then extension of credit on that collateral. So they buy these T-bonds or, you know, 10-year bonds, 20-year bonds, whatever they are, and then they will post them as collateral and they get almost 100% marginability against those bonds because there's so much demand for bonds because of the way the system is designed. So they have a ton of liquidity and so that is one of the reasons that they buy them. But if the government, meaning the Treasury, is no longer selling 10-year bonds and they're only selling T-bills, then that means the only place to go get 10-year bonds or longer bonds is from the market. And so the point of this paper is talking about how interest rates would be much higher if the government was issuing more long-term bonds. But because the government is issuing short-term bonds, it makes the supply of longer-term bonds smaller, despite all the demand that there still is for them. And so the market has gone out and bought the 10-year bonds or longer on the secondary market because that's where the supply is. So think about it. If you're used to a supply of goods and that supply continues to grow over time, and then all of a sudden that supply stops growing and all you have is existing inventory, but you need it. And so all the demand still exists, but the supply is no longer growing and perhaps even falling as those 10-year bonds come due and they, you know, get eliminated from the market, then that pushes up the price for the treasury, which brings down the yield for the treasury. So anyway, I think that's a pretty interesting thing to think about. And the one thing I'll say with this, is I don't think too many people thought of this before it happened. And I think I give these guys credit for identifying what was going on or what has been going on and why the Treasury has been issuing so much short-term paper. But one thing I would use this to make people think about is I've now been doing this. Actually, this week, I just thought of this. This week, holy cow, I can't believe I had missed this. This week is literally the 25-year anniversary of me starting on Wall Street, my Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette training program. Now, I probably wasn't smart enough at the time to even understand what central banks did. That took me a long time to figure that out, admittedly. But once I kind of did start figuring it out, you know, a lot of the stuff started to make more sense. But I can remember, so I started in 99, and the dot-com bust was less than a year later. So I got hit in the head pretty quickly in this business or to see that things don't always go up and they're not always rosy. And within 18 to 24 months of me starting in this business, I started to hear the Fed is out of bullets. There's no more moves they can make. They are behind the eight ball. They're stuck in the corner. This is a prison of their own making. They're done. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And at the time when I started hearing that, I probably didn't really understand what people were saying and what they meant. But as I got further along in this business and I started to kind of learn the role of the central bank and how things actually worked, I started to understand what they meant better. And I kept hearing it. But the point of me saying this is for almost 23 of the 25 years I've been in business, I have been hearing the government's stuck, the Fed is out of bullets, the Treasury is in trouble, they're not going to be able to get any funding, and yet they keep figuring out ways to do it. Now, I'm not saying this because I think this will always be the case and that they can never have anything go wrong. I think things are going to end up going wrong in a big way. But I'm not naive enough to think that the Fed is out of bullets. I'm not naive enough to think that the Treasury doesn't have any more tricks up their sleeve. These are very smart people. No matter what you think, or matter the jokes you hear, the memes that are sent out about central bankers, these are not stupid people. Now, they may be misguided. They may be power hungry. They may be arrogant. And these very well-played laid plans of theirs may, in fact, blow up in their faces. But these are not stupid people. And to continually think that they are, I think puts you at a disadvantage. So the next time you hear the Fed is out of bullets, there's nothing they can do, think back, or the government or the treasurer, whatever it is, think back to this, you know, conversation that we're having in this report, and that they figured out a way to get the market to do their bidding for them. And, you know, again, it doesn't mean it's always going to be the case, but I think this is a good example where some widely held beliefs have once again been proven, at least for now, to be wrong. And if really smart people can be wrong, then you can probably be wrong as well. I can be wrong as well. And so to keep an open mind and remove the words always and never from your investing vocabulary. So that's the lesson from that part of what went on in the markets this week. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is I think over the years, I have largely been assumed to be a big Treasury bull. And I kind of mentioned this at the beginning of the broadcast here. I'm actually not a Treasury bull. And I'll reference the very first conversation I had about you know, the whole dollar milkshake theory. Again, back in 2018, I did a long interview on Real Vision. It's still online. You can go watch it and you can see exactly what I said. And the story hasn't changed since that very first conversation. And essentially what that conversation said was that the 40-year bond bull market is coming to an end. Interest rates will rise and bonds will fall. I then went on to say that as a result, the dollar will go much higher. Now, I think the government is going to be, the U.S. government's going to be able to fund itself long, long time after many of the other governments around the world. But that doesn't mean that I necessarily think yields are going much lower. Again, as I mentioned a little while ago, I totally understand why they might. They could even go negative for all I know. But that's not my central bet. My central bet has been on the dollar itself. And I'm not even betting on dollars directly. I'm not holding a bunch of dollars. I'm not advocating that you own a bunch of dollars. I'm advocating to understand what happens when the dollar goes higher and with the ways to allocate your portfolio as a result. But I'll often get questioned about, well, if treasuries crash, I'm sorry, if yields crash and treasuries go up in value, doesn't that make the dollar go up in value? Well, the short answer is it could. But you know, there's this theory called the dollar smile theory, and that says that the dollar does very well in times of extreme pain, and the dollar can do well in times of extreme optimism, because in both cases people want to fly to the strongest market, and that has typically been the United States. It's kind of in the middle ground where the dollar can lose value when things are just kind of going sideways or whatever, or if things are starting to slow or starting to rise, then you can get a lower dollar. But in the extremes on each end, you typically get a stronger dollar. But more, but barring the big sell-off and extreme flight to safety, oftentimes the dollar and treasuries will trade in opposition to each other. And the reason is, if treasury prices go down, that means yields are going higher. And as yields go higher, that makes it more attractive for short-term money to park in the dollar. So again, if there's any doubts about this, just go back and look at 2022. The reason the dollar got so strong in 2022 was because treasury prices were falling, but the yields were rising. And so as the yields rose, the dollar became more attractive versus other currencies. And then not only that, if you want to buy into the U.S. stock market, you know, the first, like as an example, if you want to buy Coca-Cola, or if you want to buy an apartment in New York City, or if you want to buy ranch land in Texas, and you're a foreigner, the first thing you have to buy is dollars. And then after you have dollars, then you can go buy Coca-Cola. Then you can go buy that apartment. Then you can go buy that farmland. But the first thing you have to get is the dollars. And so as the U.S. economy becomes a more attractive place to invest, especially if there's tight monetary policy and interest rates are high, that will make the dollar rise in value. So oftentimes the dollar will trade inverse to treasury prices. So I think that's one thing that's important to know. The other thing I'm going to talk about this week is because I think this is in some ways, not by everybody, but a lot of people that are just looking at the United States are overlooking one of the things that precipitated this volatility that we've seen recently is Japan. And many times on the show, people have asked me what I worry about, what I think is going to cause things to go south in the U.S., et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is I've always been much more worried about what happens outside the United States than I am inside the United States. And I've often said, I don't know whether it's going to be Europe, whether it's going to be China, whether it's going to be Japan, which is the first domino to drop. I don't really know, because they all have their own issues. But what we've seen over the last couple of years has been that the yen has just fallen dramatically. You know, it went all the way to 160 recently. And a couple months ago, I think on one of the shows, and I think we sent it out in a tweet as well, we talked about how the 160 level on the yen would be defended pretty vigorously. And the reason is just from a technical standpoint, technical analysis, there's nothing but pure daylight above 160. And again, when you remember, when we're talking about the yen, as the yen goes higher, as the number, as you know, if the yen's at 140 and it goes to 160, and it goes from 160 to 170, that's the yen weakening. So as the cross rate with the dollar, as it rises, that's the yen weakening. And what we were saying is that there's nothing but daylight above 160, and that means that would be the yen really crashing. So if the yen went to 200, that would be a total crash, which I do think it's going to 200, by the way. You've heard me say that before. But we said that it would be defended vigorously by the Bank of Japan at 160, because if it really gets through there, then it becomes a real crisis for them. And that's exactly what we've seen. So, you know, a couple of years ago, the yen was like a 101 or 102. And then, you know, a few weeks ago, a month ago, it was at 160. So think about that. That's a 60% move in a major currency. That's an enormous move. And the yen was just, you know, losing all purchasing power, and it was starting to cause a crisis for Japan. And so the Bank of Japan raised rates recently. Now, the reason that's such a big deal is for years, Japan was stuck in a deflationary spiral. And they, more than anything, they wanted a little bit of inflation, right? And the problem is every time they would try to strengthen the currency, the way you strengthen the currency, again, we were just talking about this with relation to the dollar, is that you raise interest rates. If you raise interest rates, that makes that currency more attractive versus other currencies. But the problem with them raising interest rates is that they, for years, were issuing either zero coupon or negative yielding coupons on JGBs, the Japanese government bonds. So the pension funds, the banks, the endowments, the banking system, the investors in Japan that have bought all these Japanese government bonds. And by the way, the Bank of Japan was buying them too. They're the biggest holder. But as they buy those bonds that are either zero yielding or negative yielding, even the slightest uptick in interest rates all of a sudden causes those bond prices to fall. And if the bond prices start to fall, then all of a sudden the banking system is in trouble, or the balance sheet of the endowment in trouble, the balance sheet of the insurance company is in trouble. And it very quickly gets into a crisis. So if Japan even raises their interest rates a little bit, it would often cause problems in their banking system. And so, you know, they just couldn't do it. And as soon as they would do that, they would have to, you know, go in and reverse their policy, or say, hey, we were just kidding, or move into the market in a way to kind of stem those crises. And so the Bank of Japan has had this problem of having to save both the Japanese government bond market and save the currency. The problem is the moves to save the currency kill the bonds, and the move to save the bonds kills the currency. And so that's exactly what we've been seeing. And then over the last couple of weeks, when the yen was just in so much trouble, they didn't really have much choice. So they started raising interest rates. Well, if you start to raise interest rates, that causes, again, the bond prices to fall. But the other thing that it does is it causes the people, the institutions, and the financial entities that have, you know, entered into the yen carry trade to start thinking about, you know, we've got all this leverage on. If the interest rates continue to go higher, that's going to eat into our profits. And if the things that we bought start to fall in price, we could be upside down really quickly. So again, a carry trade is when you borrow in a currency that you think is going to fall in value, or that has a very low interest rate so that your borrowing cost is next to nothing. And then you take that money that you just borrowed and you go buy, I don't know, bonds or real estate or stocks or whatever it is. But that funding, that cheap funding, is the reason you use that currency for the carry trade. Well, if all of a sudden the price of that borrowing starts to rise, then it starts to make you wonder. And if the investments that you put that borrowed money into start to pull back, it makes you wonder again. And here's the thing, when a carry trade, especially something like the yen, like that's as big as the yen, if that starts to unwind in a hurry, well, then what that is doing, it's causing, it's basically a liquidity pull from the rest of the world back into Japan. If the liquidity is being pulled back into Japan, that means it's leaving somewhere else. Well, where is it leaving? I don't know, maybe it's leaving, you know, stocks in the U.S. Maybe it's leaving real estate in South America. Maybe it's leaving emerging market infrastructure projects. But the point is that when you get a carry trade unwind, all of a sudden it can become a liquidity issue very quickly. And once the liquidity starts to dry up, then you can start to have adverse effects in markets around the world. Now, and what we saw this week, I don't think the pullback in the U.S. and other markets was directly related to Japan. I'm just saying that it's something to think about, because if Japan continues to strengthen the yen to the detriment of its banking system, that could be an event that could then lead to problems all over the world. So far, I think the pullback in the U.S. has really been just mainly a valuation play. We haven't really had a crisis yet. There is no, there's not a lot of funding stress. You know, treasuries rallied, but, you know, high yield has not crashed and spreads haven't totally widened out. I think we could get into that situation. But as of right now, I think it's just been a garden variety correction based on valuations. But there's a lot of moving parts out there that says that could be more than this. You know, the fact that Japan is having to defend its currency while at the same time defending its bond markets, that's one thing. You know, China has had to drop interest rates dramatically recently, and now they're talking about doing helicopter money to the people in China. So they continue to have a lot of issues. You know, the war in Ukraine doesn't seem to be slowing down anytime soon. And now we got a potential military situation between Israel and Iran. So this can all spiral out of control very quickly. So far it hasn't, but it's something that we need to be on guard for. And I think, you know, we said many times year to date that we thought the second half of the year would be much more volatile than the first half of the year. And we didn't have to wait too long in the second half of the year to already start to get this volatility. I think it's very likely there's more pain to come. We'll have to wait and see kind of how severe it gets and why, and what the government does in response. But the last thing I'm going to say before we wrap up this week is, I think there's been a lot of people hoping and praying that we would start to get rate cuts in order to get, and that's why they've been buying equities, because that would send equities higher. But as we've also said many times leading up to this year, is you have to understand the reason we would get rate cuts is because of pain in the market. And pain in the market is, you know, that's what the Fed needs to see to start cutting rates. Well, do you want to go buy equities if there's pain in the markets just because the Fed is cutting? If the Fed is cutting, they see something that they think isn't good and they want to counteract that. The other thing is, if the Fed starts cutting, that starts to make the dollar less attractive. We saw the dollar pull back pretty hard on Friday. Again, that's because of rate cut expectations. If the dollar, if there starts to be rate cut expectations, that can make the dollar less attractive on a relative basis. So money, you know, kind of pulls out of the dollar. And if it pulls out of the dollar, then maybe it goes back to Japan. But the point is that I think a lot of people thought interest rates would be what caused the crash, what would be cause a slowdown. But in fact, I think over the last couple of years, interest rate hikes is what drew capital into the United States and ultimately found its way into the stock market. If they all of a sudden go into a severe rate cutting cycle, then that would mean that it's possible that those dollars turn around and leave and go elsewhere for a while. Now, I know that some people are saying, well, Brent, that's opposite of the dollar milkshake theory. The dollar milkshake theory says all the capital flows into the United States. And yes, that's absolutely right. And that is the theory. But things don't go in a straight line. There will be times where the dollar rises. There will be time where it pulls back. There will be time where U.S. stocks rise. There will be time where it pulls back. Same with bonds, same with gold, same with everything. Markets don't go in a straight line. And, you know, again, one of the things I said in the very first interview was that the dollar would go higher, U.S. equities would go higher, gold would go higher, but they would all be punctuated by terrifying drawdowns along the way. That's exactly what we've seen over the last several years. We've seen those markets all go higher, and there's been severe drawdowns along the way. It's very possible we're going to go through another drawdown right now. I think it's too early to say. I think that we are going to have a drawdown. I've talked about that for a while, but nothing is certain and nothing is guaranteed. And even if we get a pullback in the dollar and we get a pullback in equity prices, that doesn't in the long term mean that the milkshake theory is wrong. It doesn't mean that the framework is flawed. It just means that we're due for a pullback in these things. And so anyway, that's what I have to talk to you guys about this week. Thank you for tuning in. Look forward to talking to you again next week. And I'll be out talking to some people and coming up with a new format for the show next week. And perhaps we will have a guest, or perhaps you'll just get me again. But in any case, looking forward to talking to you again next week, and hope you have a safe one.